The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
This is Chatter. I'm Benjamin Wittes, Lawfare's editor-in-chief. This week on Chatter, Lawfare senior editor Roger Parloff on covering the January 6th trials.
If you don't have the resources, maybe you don't need to charge 500 misdemeanor cases. If something has to go by the wayside, I would think maybe the nonviolent misdemeanor cases rather than Trump. The only hope they have is jury nullification, which is why they want desperately to move the case someplace else. They want to get a trial where, even though they're guilty, somebody will disregard the law and the facts. If a Republican is elected, probably all these things go away. If Trump is elected, all these things go away. And so we don't have lots of time.
You are currently covering January 6th trials and litigations for Lawfare. And I want to come back to that presently. But I want to start, if I could, with how you got into the business of legal reporting in the first place. You're, unlike me, you're actually a real lawyer. You've been... but you haven't practiced in a long time. So tell us the story of how you went from a guy who went to law school, presumably to be a lawyer, to a guy who hangs out in courtrooms covering trials of people who try to overthrow the Constitution.
Well, I think I went to law school actually not planning to practice. I thought I would write about it. And I ended up practicing a little longer than I expected because I thought that would give me more street cred. But after about 5 years, I did turn to journalism.
So you went to law school intending to use it for journalism?
Either to teach or for journalism, yeah. I didn't expect to practice. Of course, in law school, you know, litigation gets a very – good press sort of, you know, that seems like the real thing. And so I wanted to try it, and I really did not have the, it's just one pissing match after another, and it's less, it doesn't become, Perry Mason until you've had about 30 years of experience. And until then, you're mainly juggling documents and bickering about, you didn't give me your documents. Well, we can't until you give me your, you know, it's just, and I wasn't cut out for it, especially at the district court level. It's very belligerent. But so after 5 years, I did step back.
What did you do before law school?
I did write for a couple years between college and law school. I was a proofreader at Esquire magazine, which... magazines were a big deal back then. This was maybe I graduated in 77, And then I was doing some freelance writing. And but after and I did a little freelance writing for New York Magazine, and then went back to law school.
When I met you for the first time, we were both working for the American lawyer media empire, which I say partly ironically and in the sense that it was a fairly small company, but partly not ironically in that a huge percentage of the people that I know who do legal journalism at the highest levels passed through the Steve Brill, Steve being the founder of the empire, passed through this network. You were, when I was a kind of cub reporter there, you were one of the star features writers at what we called Am Law, which was the American Lawyer, the sort of New York glossy magazine. Tell us about how you came to be a features writer at American Lawyer, and you know, for people who don't have never heard of the American Lawyer or heard of the sort of Steve Brill network mafia, whatever you want to call it, tell us about your history with that esteemed crime family.
Yeah, well, I go back pretty far so that. Before Steve started The American Lawyer, he was a columnist at Esquire when I was proofreading. He was probably only a couple years older than me. I mean, he was sort of a phenom. And so I met him there, and he was a terrifying figure, and nobody wanted to proofread for him. But I had successfully done so, and he seemed content with my, you know, minimalist emendations.
So just for those who when Roger says that Steve is a terrifying figure, Jill Abramson, who was one of his editors, who later went on to be the executive editor of the New York Times, described him once as a maniac, but a maniac on a mission. And yeah. I think that actually mm-hmm. captures it in a way that's pithy, but quite accurate.
Yeah, so he eventually started this his own company, The American Leader, and I helped distribute the first issue at an ABA convention in New York. I guess it would be a pilot issue to try to. And so later, after I went to law school and decided to write, I wrote to him because that would be, you know, and he gave me, he remembered me and gave me a spot with a, at that point it was, there was a weekly in Manhattan called Manhattan Lawyer with editor was Ellen Pollack, who is now the editor of the New York Times business page. And so I started there, and after maybe a year, I moved up to the magazine because I preferred longer feature writing. And I was there for a good time, and it was a good experience. I wrote a book while I was there, and he was very accommodating for that. Surprisingly, you know, patience is not the thing people usually highlight about Steve, but he was, in fact, patient, and so that was a good experience. And then, of course, he left before I did. He sold the whole thing, which was, and then around about 2000, I left to join a cool publication called Inside. Not Insider, but Inside. It was short-lived. Kurt Anderson was running it, and it had a David Carr was a writer. It had some fantastic people, and but of course it didn't last too long. It was sort of right It was as the dot-com crash was occurring. And then it was acquired by Brill's Content. So I was swallowed back. You know, you can't.
You can never entirely escape
right.
Steve Brill.
They keep pulling me back. And then September 11th happened, and all advertising collapsed. I mean, there were more serious things about 9/11 than that, but topically, and so Brill's Content folded. So then I freelanced for a couple years, and then Joe Nocera, who liked my stuff at Inside, I invited me to do some pieces for Fortune, and that led to him hiring me. He wasn't the editor, but he was my rabbi, and I joined Fortune and had some good years there.
So I'm interested in, you have always thought of yourself, and I've always thought of you principally as a legal writer, but you've done some business reporting, you've done some other stuff as well. How do you think about the parameters of your career? From my point of view, and I think of you as you and Stuart Taylor as kind of the paradigmatic American lawyer features writers. But what's from your point of view, what are the through points of the Roger Parloff oeuvre?
Well, it was mainly legal writing, but I mean, writing about legal topics. But it was a pretty broad palette, both at American. It was broader at American Lawyer because there was a lot of criminal stuff, and at Fortune, there was antitrust, there was digital copyright, which was, you know, a very exciting area with Napster, very interesting. There was antitrust with Microsoft. And then I did, you know, stray sometimes and did sort of pure tech things, which were also quite interesting, the early artificial intelligence stuff. I did one about a Ferrari rally, and I drove three Ferraris over a 3-day stretch from Napa Valley to Monterey across the most beautiful roads that Ferrari could find, because they provide these rallies for their people, because you buy these beautiful cars, but there isn't much to do with them because they're very, very impractical. So people, you know, like once a year, they'll put their cars on a truck and they ship them out to these rallies. Ferrari will have found some routes where, you know, some sinuous routes where that you can really get going and hug the road. And they're just fabulous. And somebody else tunes the car for you, and that was a sort of a great detour from my normal gig.
But like me, you've always come back to meaty legal questions rather than, you know, cars of the rich and famous or, right? I mean, like some people kind of left the American Lawyer Group and left legal reporting. You and I have in common that it sort of remained who we were, essentially.
Yeah, it did. And after I left Fortune in 2016, I began freelancing. I actually, for a year, I ran, well, I was the editor-in-chief, but the only editor, the only employee of a publication called Opioid Watch that was trying to follow the opioid crisis. But that it didn't last very long at all, and it's a rough topic. That's a rough topic, and surprisingly, as you quickly learn when you get into it, you might think that following the opioid crisis would be sort of non-controversial, but actually it's exceedingly controversial because the people with chronic pain are terribly worried about losing their opioids, and so just calling it opioid crisis is controversial, you know, because they need their opioids and they're afraid the world is cracking down and anyway, so that was a rough gig, and then. And then we came down to Washington to be closer to my daughter and her then one grandchild, now two. And by then I had written one story for Lawfare, just, you know, because I liked the publication. And so I'd done a one-off there. And so I called you. And, of course, there was no money. But you said you would get some, and you did, and the rest is history.
Yeah, so let's talk about that history, because I think you have done something that is genuinely different from the way other publications have covered post-January 6th litigation, and... One of the components of it is that, you know, a lot of the people who cover this litigation are the federal courts reporters for various big publications, the Washington Post, Politico, the New York Times, right? They have these people who cover what's ever going on in the courthouse, including that gets dominated by January 6th. But they're doing other things at the same time. And you're part of a small group of people who just aren't doing anything else, that this is kind of what you're doing. So I'm curious how you break down the group of people who you're working with in, you know, who are the ones that are kind of doing the same thing that you're doing? Who are the ones that flit in and out? And I'm not criticizing them or anything, but they're covering a million things, and this is one. And who are the and how many people when there's a case going on in the press room, you've just never seen them before?
It's usually the same people. It's mainly the same people for each case. But I have been able because we're a nonprofit, really. I have been able to devote, you know, deranged amounts of time to the cases that we thought were the most important, particularly the Oath Keepers' first seditious conspiracy case and the Proud Boys' seditious conspiracy case. And the other publications do cover those, and they cover them well, but there is a small group of people that really would like to basically follow along like a baseball game and really get the play-by-play. And there are only two of us in a position to do that. Me and Brandy Buckman has also done that as well. And others do some good tweeting too, but they're usually called away because of obligations, you know, they can't really follow one case, and they've got to. There's 1,000 January 6th cases, and a lot of them are interesting and important. So, and the people that are called away began to appreciate what we did. It gave them a chance. You know, this is much less. Nobody can afford a transcript for a trial that goes 62 days, and most people can't afford it for one day, and so this. Is not a transcript, but it is a nice
it's transcript adjacent.
Yeah, and it's there's been quite an appetite for it, and it's been fun to do. And the folks at the media room have been very welcoming and appreciative. And when I was a kid, I liked I grew up nearby. Even though I spent most of my life in New York, so I followed the Washington Senators. This will date me some, And so I listened to the games on my transistor radio, Dan Daniels and John McLean. And they would root for the Senators, but basically they tried to be fair, you know. And I thought the Baltimore announcers were more biased, but I strived for the Washington Senators approach and, you know, just the facts, ma'am, as much as possible. And there was an appetite for that. And you learn a case. I mean, it's just there's nothing like it in terms of really understanding a case. And it's been fascinating.
So who are the reporters and scholars who are covering these cases in the broadest sense? I mean, I'm thinking not just of reporters, but also of data aggregators and, you know, folks who are, you know, providing information about these cases. Who are the ones who you have particular confidence in? And when you go to, one thing you're doing is not just sitting through long cases, but you're also writing about the cases as a group. Right, you're also writing about arguments that are being made in across multiple cases. So at some points, you're relying on other people's work as well as your own. Who are the people who are working in this space whose work you really trust?
Seamus Hughes at the George Washington University Program on Extremism, his group has been extremely helpful, and his website has been extremely helpful.
And explain for those who've never been to it, what is that website doing that is adding value here?
They've been, from the very beginning, keeping track of documents in the case and keeping track of statistics and slicing and dicing the statistics in various ways. And occasionally they do reports. So they're a very useful group.
So, for example, just to make this vivid, if you want to know how many people have been convicted of felonies or whose cases are still pending and who have been accused of violent crimes as opposed to trespassing, right? This is data you can access that helps you evaluate that.
Exactly. And the DOJ itself has some useful websites as well that help process this. NPR has a fairly good searchable website as well. I'm sure I'm leaving people out. There are people that sort of help me when I'm live tweeting that often they often don't use their real names, but maybe some do, but they are among the sort of sedition hunters who really have pored over the open source video and in an astounding way, and have helped the DOJ to identify potential people to pay attention to. So those people sort of in real time sometimes correct mistakes or show me things that lead me to avenues to pursue, identify peripheral characters, correct my spellings. So they've been useful. And then, I do read the daily stuff. I'm going to leave out people, but the Washington Post has done some good statistics about sentencings and Spencer Hsu and Rachel Weiner and Tom Jackman, and then NPR's Kerry Johnson is, I follow her. Kyle Chaney covers an astounding number of beats. I don't know how it's possible.
He also did the January 6th committee litigations in the middle of this thing.
Yeah. And then Jordan Fisher of the local CBS station knows knows these cases as well as anyone, with the possible exception of Ryan J. Riley of NBC, who's also, you know, they really have seen it all. And then CNN has done important stuff. So, you know, I'm going to leave people out inadvertently, but I try to keep abreast. Alan Foyer of the Times has done a lot of breaking news. So I have to keep abreast of all of this. I don't know if nobody remembers the guy on the Ed Sullivan Show that, you know, kept all the plates going across the stage. That's what it's like.
Do you think, as a general matter, that the press has done a good job covering the January 6th cases? I mean, you know, people talk about it as a taxing thing for the Justice Department, for the courts, for the defense bar. You know, yeah, each of these people has to get a lawyer, right? But actually, positioning the press to cover 1,200 serious criminal cases and to do them both justice as individual cases but also as a pattern of cases, right, is a major league undertaking as a reporting matter. How do you evaluate the press's performance?
I'm very impressed. Incidentally, I'm going to flash back and I realize I omitted mention of Marcy Wheeler, Empty Wheel. You need to follow her. I don't know how she does it. She reads every document in 1,000 cases. That's another sort of vital thing. Plus, if I don't mention her, she's going to really ream me out.
Marcy has a long history of a antagonistic relationship with Lawfare that has recently, in the last several years, become a alternately warm and antagonistic relationship with Lawfare. And I never know whether she's going to respond to something on Lawfare by embracing it or by attacking it. I think she makes an immense contribution, partly just because she reads every scrap of paper, and there's nobody else who has 360 visibility on as much of the criminal docket as she does.
Yeah, I that's right. Going back to the press, obviously the people on the right are obviously not satisfied with the press. They feel it's biased. What I see is, it's sort of incredible what the daily reporters do in terms of taking these incredibly complex cases and boiling them down and putting something that is fair, in my humble opinion, and doing it on deadline and doing it at the end of a day when you've watched this thing, you're trying to pay attention to every word, and then you have to put it down on paper, which fortunately, when I'm live tweeting, I don't typically have to do.
Because you're sort of doing something more like a transcription.
Yeah. So I'm done. And when I do finally, want to write something, I take my sweet time, have some weekends and think about it. But these people at the end of the day somehow need to bring it together and do it in, 1,200 words, it's amazing.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com. One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. Want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers and that the one with the most information about me was called HLEC. I have no idea what HLEC is. So the other day, I got my latest report, and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there, and these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code LAWFARE20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/LAWFARE20, code LAWFARE20. So my old colleague on the Washington Post editorial page, Peter Milius, whom I was privileged to work with for a couple of years when I first got there before he died very suddenly, he told me on my first day of as an editorial page writer that, and I'll never forget this metaphor, that he every day gets to watch a show, and he would watch the show, and he could call the actors, and they would all take his calls, and so he could talk to people in the show. And then at the end of every day, he would write a little review of the show. And then the next day, here's the punchline, the review would become the opening act of the show, and he would do it again. And I think that's a really good – it's a really good metaphor for editorial writing, but it's also in some ways a good metaphor for beat reporting, where you're dealing with repeat players every day, and everybody's reading – everything that everybody writes. And so, you know, if you're covering the Oath Keepers, one group of people who's reading, you know, what Roger Parloff is live tweeting about the Oath Keepers is the Oath Keepers. And you know, you said you had a desire to be like the announcers or the broadcasters for the Washington Senators. So are the Oath Keepers in this context analogizable to the players for the other team? Like, if we take this metaphor,
no, I don't think I want to go there
at
exactly.
face value. Like, who are the, like, how do you understand, like, who's the home team? Who's the away team?
No, I do. You know, when I'm taking this down, I try to play it straight, and there's a lot of people have appreciated that, and I have had some of the defendants following me, and sometimes they point out, you know, good things, you know, when I'm inadvertently biased, I do have opinions, and they come out eventually. I've been trying to lay it down the middle, and I do think that among all of the cases there, you know, these seditious conspiracy cases have the most genuine issues, you know, like with the run-of-the-mill case, there's sort of shaving a haircut cases that there's – people are, you know, the issue is, you know, they've been filmed from every which way, you know, they've been
– And half of them did the filming themselves,
yeah,
and posted
they've filmed,
it on
Yeah, they've got a 360
media.
Camera on their helmet, you know, and they've written beforehand that they're going to do an insurrection. They've written afterwards, boy, I stormed the Capitol. It was great. And then they filmed themselves, and then there's 550 Capitol surveillance cameras, and there's hundreds of TV and selfies from the rioters. You know, the only hope they have is jury nullification, which is why they want desperately to move the case someplace else. It's not because they're not getting a fair trial. It's because they want to get a trial where, even though they're guilty, somebody will disregard the law and the facts. And there are certainly jurisdictions where I think that would happen. I think in the big conspiracy cases, there are more legitimate issues where, you know, reasonable people could disagree, especially about the top charges, seditious conspiracy. So those are the cases I've paid most attention to. So mm-hmm. I've tried to play it fairly straight.
So I want to talk about this Washington Post story that ran mm-hmm. over the weekend, which relates to a set of issues that you and I have been talking about for more than a year now, which is the relationship between these cases, what you call the blue-collar January 6th cases, and the political echelon cases. And as you know, the story basically reports that the FBI and the Justice Department were slow to get off the ground on the white collar cases, being determinedly focused both for reasons of deterrence of future violence and out of a certain caution about getting involved in political echelon cases involving the Trump White House, focused really on the blue collar cases. And so, first of all, I'm just interested in your reaction to the story, both as somebody who takes the blue collar violence very seriously, but also as somebody who's been, I think it's fair to say, perturbed by the slowness of the white collar investigation. What did you make of the story?
Well, I thought it was an impressive piece of reporting. There have been questions raised that I have not had a chance to study and see whether there are merits to it. There are people that are taking issue with the timeline.
Including both Marcy Wheeler and Kyle Chaney,
yeah,
both of whom we mentioned earlier, yeah, as people who are interesting on this subject.
Yeah, but what the Post did seem to take the view, which I think Andrew Weissman has been taking for a long time, that there was this sort of crazy or misguided or overly cautious or prudential insistence on only following the blue collar cases and hoping that eventually you would flip and flip and flip and the top people would jump
the collar color barrier.
Yeah, yeah, and reach the white collar people. You know, like maybe Rhodes could give you Ali Alexander and Alex Jones, and then you would go all the way up to the president. That, if that was the plan, that didn't work. The thing about it,
but can I ask a question about that? Was that like, so today we know, and sort of after some period of investigating the blue collar cases, it became clear that the blue collar cases were not going to deliver the white collar cases. But was that an unreasonable theory for the Justice Department to start with? Like, okay, like treat this as the mob. The mob, you go after the little guys, they flip, they give you the bigger guys. You get the mid-level guys flip, they give you. That's what they've been doing with the Trump Organization, right? Was that an unreasonable theory, or was it a good theory that turned out to be wrong?
I think the thing about it that seemed off to me is you knew from before Merrick Garland arrived in the office, March 2021, you knew before then about this Trump phone call to Raffensperger. I don't know how you ignore that. You know, are you hoping that, you know, 2 years down the road, Rhodes will tell you something that will tell you something about, you know, there's a separate problem going on. You know, what is he doing calling Raffensperger? And I don't.
And you have a similar issue with some of the fake electors,
yes,
stuff.
That, yeah,
that stuff comes out and the department seems kind of sluggish about it.
They refuse. People want to, well, according to the Post story, if I'm remembering correctly, people want to pursue it, and they're told not to at that stage. I think NARA early on, NARA had tried to get, you know, they noticed early on they had sort of six or seven nearly identical sort of fake
electors,
yeah, things that were filed with them. And they notified the DOJ, and nothing happened to it until more than a year. Some of these delays seem to have to do with there was trouble getting a new U.S. attorney approved. That doesn't happen till November.
And the 2021. And the assistant attorney general for national security.
Yes, that was the other key one. So, you know, there were some problems like that. But no, I really don't think that, you know, if that pursuing one attack only. I can't really see it in light of huge clues like that, that something else was going on.
So one thing that I would say if I were making the case for Merrick Garland is, first of all, nothing really turned on this, right? So you do things slowly and methodically, and you open later than people think you should. And there are a few good reasons for that. One is you've got literally thousands of cases on your plate. And, you know, in retrospect, the Raffensperger call seems really important. But what you're really concerned about in real time is Stuart Rhodes and, you know, Enrique Tarrio, right? And so, like, the salience of these issues clarifies over time, and that's fine. Another thing you might say is, well, the real concern in the short term, and the Post says this, was in deterring violence at the Biden inauguration. You wanted to get as many people off the streets as you could. And, you know, statutes of limitations being what they are, you're going to have plenty of time later to deal with the political echelon if the evidence supports that. And then the third thing, which, you know, is you say, okay, Fani Willis has investigated one element of this, you know, only the part that involves Georgia. And it's taken her as much time as it's taken the Justice Department with 1,000 other cases, literally 1,000 other cases, and with all the other fake elector stuff and with everything else that was going on in the Justice Department and with, you know, the Mar-a-Lago investigation arising separately. And so maybe if Merrick Garland were here, what he'd say is, hey, this wasn't the, you know, even under the best of circumstances, if you can focus only on this, it's still a 2-year investigation. And I'm wondering if, you know, both Andrew Weissman and the other people who have criticized the pace of this investigation are actually just underestimating how intensive this investigation was necessarily going to be.
Well, all of this is, you know, second-guessing people who know a ton more than I know, you know, and so I feel uncomfortable. But I would say a couple things. I don't know that we have lots of time. We're already at a stage where each indictment brought Trump saying, oh, it's election interference. Now I'm running again. If a Republican is elected, probably all these things go away. If Trump is elected, all these things go away. And so we don't have lots of time. Fani Willis, as I understand it, it sounds like she has been trying to do an investigation beyond just Georgia. And that's one of the sort of crazy things about having her do it. It's been very hard to try to get the subpoenas honored in other states.
No, but she hasn't. She's been trying to do investigative conduct beyond Georgia, but she hasn't been investigating the effort to overturn the election in Arizona or in Wisconsin or in Pennsylvania.
Okay. Well, I assume that's true, but even so, the call, you know, Trump called Raffensperger. He wasn't trying to become president of Georgia. You know, he was trying to become president of the United States. And so the fraud is on the United States. This is fundamentally a federal issue, And it's much easier to subpoena for the federal government to subpoena everyone relevant than it is for Fannie Willis. Of course, it is nice that Fannie Willis, that, you know, nobody has the pardon power to nullify what she does. But that's a bonus. It's not a substitute. And so I still don't really – I think, you know, if I were to continue to second guess, you know, I think you could ask, well, if you don't have the resources – maybe you don't need to charge 400 misdemeanor cases, 500 misdemeanor cases against the nonviolent people. I understand the point people are making, and there is a point to it. But if something has to go by the wayside, I would think maybe the nonviolent misdemeanor cases rather than Trump, you know.
Right. So is your working understanding that the Proud Boys and Oath Keepers cases are kind of the high water mark of the January 6th litigation in the Barrett-Prettyman courthouse, and now we're on the sort of downslope of January 6th street-level violence? And, you know, I don't know what to call them, rioters, insurrectionists, the street level stuff has peaked. We're past max January 6th accountability for that group.
I think that's right. Unless, you know, we ever pick up the trail of the pipe bomb people, I don't know what was happening there. But That's my sense. There are some 3%er trials out there that, but I think they're. I don't think they're the main event.
And what about? So what does that mean for the group of people we've talked about, who have been basically, you know, covering these cases for the last 2 years? Does this energy all shift to Mar-a-Lago and you all go hang out in Miami, or is it or does the sort of gang kind of break up at this point?
I don't know. That's a good question. One of them, I'm not going to say who, seems to have been sort of his assignment has metamorphosed some. Maybe there is a sense that we've reached an inflection point. I certainly am focused more on the white collar stuff and waiting to see what happens there. We do have these interesting cases that are at different stages, the Peter Navarro case and the Bannon appeal. Those are very difficult
these
issues.
These are contempt of Congress cases.
Yeah, those are very difficult, thorny legal issues and rather small stakes criminal, you know, those are misdemeanor level crimes.
Right. I think all the small stakes in terms of their jail time, but I think quite large stakes in terms of Congress's ability to enforce subpoenas.
Yeah, that's true.
So you say you have your eye on the white collar stuff. I watch this investigation and I honestly can't figure out what Jack Smith is really looking at. You get these subpoenas, you get these people wandering into the grand jury. Sometimes it seems like it's about Mike Pence and the pressure on him. Sometimes it seems like it's about fake electors. Sometimes it seems like it's about, it seems to bounce around. And I don't have a sense of how close to done it is. What if you were in Vegas laying odds on where things are in the January 6th investigation, what's your work in theory of it?
I don't know when it's or if it's coming down, but I think there is a sort of unified field theory that will bring into account the false electors scheme and the pressure on Pence, pressure on DOJ. It would be enormous and sprawling, but it would be a massive conspiracy. Maybe that's too impractical. So they'll break it down and try to look for something that's cleaner. Mail frauds based on false statements in campaign funding. But that would be really nibbling around the edges. And for me, I know you probably think the First Amendment issues are too great, but I still think there is a basic instigating an insurrection, incitement of a riot, incitement of an insurrection. I think those are winnable cases under the extraordinary facts.
So why you have now sat through two seditious conspiracy cases, why could you not charge the former president of the United States with seditious conspiracy as they have the statute is incredibly broad, so assume we're limiting it now by its enforcement history. What's the gap in the facts that says that case would not be plausible?
There's a lot of avenues with Trump where you could allege a conspiracy to hold on to power in various ways, but not who are the other conspirators besides him that want to use force against the United States? Who is he conspiring? Does Mark Meadows want to use force? I think they want to use these false elector schemes, or they want to use pressure on Pence. I think those are their schemes, and those do not involve the use of force. I think the only one you can say with any clarity wants force is the guy, yelling, "You've got to go fight or you won't have a country anymore," 36 minutes before the barriers fall. The guy that summoned all the people there, that said, "We'll be wild." It's, the guy that knows about that people don't want to go through the magnetometers because they're armed and wants people to let them in anywhere. They're not here for me.
But it seems a little odd to say you can't have a conspiracy because there are no plausible co-conspirators. The immediate White House staff doesn't count because they didn't want to use force. And the people who wanted to use force, the people who responded to it, don't count because they were just following Trump's instructions. There was never an agreement between them. But couldn't you say, hey, the "will be wild" tweet, come to January 6th, "will be wild," was an invitation. When you show up in response to that invitation, that's the agreement. And then when the president says, "We're going to march down to the Capitol and you got to fight like hell or you're not going to have a country anymore," and you go do it, that's the agreement. Do you have to have met your co-conspirators? I don't think so.
You don't have to have met all of them. There does have to be a meeting of the minds. I don't know if you can just, post on the internet, "Come here, let's wink, wink, do violence," and then everyone that shows up is your co-conspirator.
Right, because it's not. That's more of an incitement than it is so you think, as a realistic matter, there is no even thinking broadly about the seditious conspiracy cases that have been brought. There's no plausible, absent more evidence, there's no plausible seditious conspiracy case against Trump or his inner circle.
Yeah, this could be dead wrong, but I don't see who else wants force, to use force besides him. So I think that's a problem. You have conspiracy to obstruct an official proceeding, assuming that charge holds up. But I think it's stronger against Trump than against most January 6th people. I think he's obviously seeking a personal benefit, which isn't true of most of the January 6th people. So I don't think corruptly is a hard problem there.
You still have the question of whether whether the act involves shredding documents tampering with witnesses. Yeah. Although I think, again, the case there is a little bit better with respect to Trump, because he is, I don't think Pence is a witness exactly, but he is calling everybody. He's doing things that we think of as sort of like lobbying, right? And I don't – that's a different issue from, putting your shoulder to the door. But it does seem a little bit closer to the sort of the most restrictive reading of the statute.
There's also one other conspiracy statute they've used, which is the Criminal Ku Klux Klan Act 18 U.S.C. 372, which is I guess that one also requires the use of force, however. So you would need a conspiracy to use force, and you run into the same problem. It's also only a six-year felony compared to the 20-year felony of corrupt obstruction of an official proceeding, or the 10-year felony instigating it. Insurrection.
Do you think that the Mar-a-Lago case, I mean, I think a lot of people have said the Mar-a-Lago case is a possible surrogate case for Jack Smith. As somebody who's watched a lot of other people go down over January 6th, I imagine that doesn't sit all that well with you. From your point of view, is what's the relationship between a January 6th prosecution and a Mar-a-Lago prosecution?
It's not a substitute. You've prosecuted more than 1,000 people, and they all will tell you, and it's obvious, why are they there? They're there because of Trump. And, to not go after him is just obscene. Also, at this point, Mar-a-Lago being brought in Florida, extremely dicey, I would say. It seemed like a slam dunk until I realized, venue really sort of forces you to bring it there. And then you come into the jury nullification issue. I don't know if it will be conscious or subconscious, but there is just such I think the obstacles to be overcome with the jury and with the judge are enormous.
So, Roger, I'm in keeping with the form of chatter, I'm going to pull a question from the chatter box and ask you. Here we go. Who played the best Bond?
I'm a Sean Connery guy.
Yeah, I mean, that's really a question with a right answer.
I will say I did see the current guy.
Daniel Craig.
Yeah. It's a different thing, but he's a great new twist on it, but it's probably more faithful to the Bond in the books.
Although fidelity to the Bond in the books is gets into some nasty territory for other reasons. But yes, I agree with you.
You know, the books are very brutal
and also deeply, deeply racist.
Oh, that I didn't remember.
Yeah, each of the books has a different foreign non-British villain who is always a cultural stereotype of some either continental European villain or ethnic minority villain. They're really profoundly xenophobic.
I used to like when I was learning French, I started reading the Arsène Lupin stories. And if you read the short stories, it's a good thing to start with. And they're short and, you know, engrossing. And then finally I read one of his novels and wow, was it racist. I just bowled over. You really go back too far into, and it was colonialist, and he's there alone, you know, fighting off thousands of Berbers and his stuff, and it's not very good at a gender level either. But
right, well, that's
I guess DeSantis would like it. It's very unwoke.
That's certainly true of the Ian Fleming books. Roger Parloff, this has been a pleasure. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
That was Chatter, a production of Lawfare and Goat Rodeo. Please subscribe to the podcast and find us on Twitter at That Was Chatter.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.